Call Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is March 25th. We're in the State Capitol Senate Finance Room. Present today are Chairman Olson, Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have two items on today's agenda. The first being Senate Bill 24, Permanent Fund POMV, available for appropriation. And the second item is Senate Bill 227, Tax Compact, Sales Tax, Oil and Gas Tax. That brings us to the first item on today's agenda, Senate Bill 24, Permanent Fund POMV, available for appropriation. We will hear a presentation on the Permanent Fund draw analysis from Callan. Callan is on the line. Callan, please identify yourself for the record. We have someone to flip the slides for you. So when you're ready to go to the next slide, please say switch slides. You have the floor.
Thank you. For the record, this is Greg Allen, CEO and Chief Research Officer at Callan, the longtime consultant to the Alaska Permanent Fund, and I'm here to make a brief presentation on some work that I've done looking at SB 274 and its implications for the draw and for the permanent funds. And so forth. So if we can just go to the very first slide, which is actually slide two, which is the outline, I'm going to give a little bit of a perspective on the historical results, how this would have behaved in the past. I'm then going to talk a little bit about the mechanics of 274, just so everybody's clear on what I've done, and then I have a model that looks out about 20 years to see the impact, and it's a pretty simple model, but it does take into account all the mechanics of the permanent fund. But I'm focusing on sort of the median or the middle outcome, as opposed to looking at the worst case outcomes. So that's the plan, and of course I have plenty of time for questions. But if you have questions in the middle, please interrupt me. All right. So if I could advance to the next slide, which is slide number three, and the page number on the bottom right. This is an exhibit that I showed at the last time I was up there. And what this exhibit shows you, the orange line is, going back from the beginning of 2000, this is the CPI plus five. This is what you would this is what it would look like if you earned CPI plus five, every single quarter since 2000. The blue line is the permanent fund's actual net of fee return over that same period. And if you'll recall, I was just pointing out the fact that because you have to take risk to earn CPI plus five over the long run, you can have periods where you're behind and periods where you're ahead. In this particular case, I chose this time period because it started off poorly. And so when time periods start off poorly, you get behind, and it often takes a long time to catch up. And my final point is that over this 25-year period, the permanent fund is actually behind CPI plus 5. Okay. So, and there are many other periods where it's ahead of CPI plus 5. In fact, if you just go back to start this thing in 1995, which I show, it's actually ahead. So it's very time period specific, but I like this time period because of what it shows on the next page. So if we can go to the next slide. The only thing that I've changed between these two slides is now the orange line represents CPI plus 4.5%. So you can see that miraculously, the permanent fund hits that number almost exactly at the end of 2025 and stayed much closer to it in spite of the dot-com and the global financial crisis and COVID, et cetera. So this just illustrates that even though it's a 0.5% difference in the target, over the long run with compounding, it makes a pretty big difference in the outcome. And so the permanent fund over this 25-year period would have met that CPI plus 4.5%, which, of course, is the draw rate that's being contemplated at the end of the introduction period for the SB 274. I'll stop, and if there are any questions, please ask.
Any questions from Senate Finance Committee members? Seeing none, Mr. Allen, please proceed.
All right. If we can go to the next slide. I'm just giving you a little bit longer perspective on CPI, on earning 5% real, CPI plus 5. So in this chart, the blue line, we don't have returns going back to 1926 for all of the asset classes that the permanent fund uses. So I'm using a 70-30 stock bond portfolio as a proxy for the permanent fund's kind of current risk posture, which is about right. And so I'm showing the blue line is the trailing 10-year return for that 70-30 mix, and the orange line is the 5% real. So I'm just giving you a perspective of how many, what percentage of the time, if you look back 10 years, over the last 100 years, would you have been ahead of 5% real? And you can see about 65%, 64% of the time, you'd be ahead, and about 36% of the time, you'd be behind. So that's a very, very long-term perspective. So you can't invest in anything where you're always going to be ahead. There's going to be periods where you're behind and periods where you're ahead, and that's just the way investments work. So the next slide, all I do on slide 6 there is the orange line just drops by 0.5%, so I'm showing 4.5%, but the percentage of times that you're ahead now bumps up from 64 to 71. So, again, 4.5 is an easier target to beat than 5. And that would be a lot of trouble to show that very simple concept. But it does matter, kind of given the risk profile of the permanent fund and what's reasonable in terms of what the expectation that they can earn over long periods of time. All right. The next slide is simply a review of something I did the last time. I just want to mention this. This is me going back in time to the beginning of 2000 and assuming that you had a 5% draw the whole time and, you know, invoking the ERA limit. So these are actual returns for the permanent fund, actual statutory net income, you know, all those things actually happened. And then we've overlaid this new 5% draw, which is what we're operating with right now, where it's 5% of the first 5 years of the last 6 years. So I just, you know, went through this just to show that there were some periods, for example, in 2009, where the earnings reserve account, the two-account system, would have come into play, and you would not have been able to make the 5% draw in 2009 and even into 2010. And there's some other periods in here where it kicks in and you're not able to make the full draw. So, and then just to review, on the next slide, this is what I showed, same thing I showed last time. All I've done here is overlay the 4.5% draw. So even with this reduced draw in 2009 and in 2010, and a little bit in 2013, you would have fallen short of what the 4.5% formula would have required. So, and that's just, again, the ERA kicking in. Importantly, I think we started this period with a very low balance in the ERA. And like I said, 2001, 2002 were not great investment years. So, you know, in some senses, this is probably a worst-case scenario. Right now, we've got a very healthy ERA. If we'd started this with a big, giant ERA, you know, you might have been able to survive 2009. I'm not sure. But we're definitely in a better, more healthy position with a big balance in the ERA right now than we were back in 2001. All right, so that's the history. Now what I've done, I want to talk a little bit about the draw mechanics of 274. As I understand it, I read the bill. So the idea is that starting in 2029, so 26, 27, and 28, the bill does not do anything to the draw, as I understand it. And then beginning in 29, the draw starts to ratchet down at 0.1% a year for the, until it gets down to 4.5% in 2033. So I think what's important to note is the formula takes the five-year average and, you know, it looks back 6 years. So my point for showing this slide is that it takes a long time for the effect of this bill to fully impact the permanent fund draw model. Because, you, first of all, you got to get all the way to 4.5%, and that takes until 2033. And that's the first year that the lower draw takes a full effect on the market value. So when you reduce the draw, the market value is bigger, and it can earn more money. But it's not until you get to 2039 where the 4.5% is fully realized. So I just want to make sure everybody understands this is a long-term commitment to a more sustainable draw, but it is going to take a long time for it to work itself into the system compared to just adopting 4.5% starting tomorrow. And there's some good things about that, but the benefits of the savings that it's going to create over the 5% draw take a fairly long time to be realized. All right, I'll stop. Any questions? Everybody okay with that?
Any questions on this slide? Mr. Allen, please proceed.
All right. So we'll move to the next slide. And so what I did was I've got a bunch, and I'm sorry about these being tables, and they're probably hard to read, but because I'm going out 20 years, they didn't really lend themselves to graphs either. So we're kind of stuck with this. But hopefully you can see these numbers. So all I've done here is, and this is the median, you know, depending on what happens in the markets, these numbers could be different, but this is kind of the middle. The expectation is that you kind of earn about what Callan has projected you're going to earn given the permanent fund's current portfolio, which is about 7.3% per year. And it just looks at the draw under the two formulas. So you can see for the first 3 years, they're effectively the same. They are the same. And then after that, they start to diverge with SB 274 draw being lower than the 5% draw. But importantly, the draw, at least in this median case, doesn't go down. So while you are absorbing a lower draw rate, you aren't actually getting less money than you did the year before. So I think that's a nice feature of this versus if you took the whole 4.5% in 1 year. I mean, it would still take a while to work its way in, but you know, you might have years where, at least a year, where the draw actually goes down year over year. Now, of course, if there's bad markets, you know, you still can have situations where the draw goes down under both formulas. So I don't want to say that this protects you from the draw never going down. But in the expected case, the median case, because this is feathered in over time, you never are expecting to have a year where the draw drops year over year because of the new formula. And you can see that all the way out to 2045, you're still getting a bigger draw out of the 5% draw than you are out of 274. So it does take a long time to catch up. It's going to be somewhere in the 2055 range, but there's going to be a point where you actually are going to have a bigger dollar draw out of the 274A, even though it's a smaller percentage, because you've been saving. The market value gets bigger. And that's a nice segue into the next page. Well, first off, all right, this next one's a little bit complicated, but I think it's an important point. And then I'll talk about the market value after that. So this next slide on slide 11, the columns are the change in the draw every year, okay? So under the 5% draw, and again, this is the expected, the middle, the median case, the draw is expected to go up every year, right? If you're interested in what happens in 28, I can explain that, but it has to do with the five-year average and there being one of the years dropped out, and that caused a drop in the average market value. So it has nothing to do with, it just has to do with the mechanics and what has happened in the past with the market value of the fund. But what you see with the SB 274 is that, you know, it's projected to go up each year, 29, 30, 31, but by a smaller amount, by you know, roughly a third of what's happening over with the 5% draw. But eventually, when you get to 2036, the SB 274A draw actually goes up each year by more dollars than the 5% draw. And this is when, because you're starting to realize the benefit of a higher market value, and so you're going to get a faster growth rate in dollars out of the 274 draw, the 4.5% draw, than the 5% draw. So starting in about 36, if you hold on that long, you actually have a little bit more each year in the year before than you would under the 5% draw. You haven't hit the level yet, but you're growing faster, and that's why you get the crossover eventually. All right. Now if we can flip to market values, this is where you see the more immediate benefit of the lower draw. The orange, it just shows sales where the 274 is higher than the 5% draw. So this is relatively straightforward. Under 274, you're taking a little bit less out, and so you have more left. So pretty much under any scenario, whether the market goes up, market goes down, if you take less out, you will have more than if you take more out. And so this sort of shows that. And so the projection in the middle of the range is that when you get to 2045, you'll have about $13 billion more in the permanent fund than you would. And of course, you know, you're earning 4.5%, you're drawing 4.5% of that $13 billion. So you can see, you know, why they eventually cross over. I'm sorry, to 12.2 billion. I shouldn't have said 13, sorry. Okay. So far, so good. Any questions?
No questions. Please continue.
All right. Okay, so again, this is sort of just accelerating off that last point. This is my last slide. This just shows you the change in market value. It's just another way of looking at it, but you can see that it's growing by an increasing rate under the 4.5% draw because you're earning, you have more money compounding, and so the market value is projected to increase by $5.5 billion in 2045 year over year under the SB 274 and by only $4.3 billion under the 5% draw. So you can see, I guess, the point of all of this, you know, was just to go through the mechanics to show how it takes a while for this to kick in. It shouldn't be too painful while it is, and that you end up with a more sustainable draw over time. This will help you in good markets. It'll help you in bad markets. It's just like good savings behavior. So that concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm available for questions if there are any.
I have one that seems to be of interest to people in Alaska. Under the current formula of 5% draw, what year do we reach $100 billion in the fund? And under the Senate Bill 274, what year would we reach $100 billion? Do you have those numbers, or if not, maybe you could.
They're on slide 12. And somewhere between 2030 and 2031, you will cross $100 billion under both bills, or wait, I'm sorry, under both spending rules. So because it takes time for 274 to kick in, and you're actually spending the same under both models for the first 3 years, you're almost there by then. And because the amount that you spend notches down ever so slightly in each you're under 274 instead of all at once. By 2031, again, this is an immediate case. If we have a big market correction or, you know, anything can happen in the capital markets, but assuming you kind of hit the middle of the road, we're projecting somewhere between 2030 and 2031 under both scenarios.
Further questions of Mr. Allen? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Allen, I don't believe it's in the modeling. Can you help us think through what the likely impact of the earnings reserve limit that you talked about in the early slides can be in the two scenarios, the 5% and the eventual 4.5% draw scenario? Is that something we should be thinking hard about, or does that kind of come out in the wash?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I've done some work. I actually have a model now that simulates volatility, and it goes out 20 years. I didn't have that last time I was there, so I'm able to look at the interaction of this bill going out 20 years with volatility. You know, on balance, the less you spend. So the slightly long answer to your question is it kind of depends on what the legislature appropriates out of the ERA between now and the future, right? So right now we've got a healthy balance in the ERA, and we've also got a fair amount of unrealized gains sitting in the portfolio. And so when you, just through time, if you have unrealized gains, they get realized and that gets added to the ERA as well. So you're in a really healthy situation right now. And so when I run the model out 20 years, neither of these spending rules run into problems with the ERA frequently. It's like a 10% probability. The probability is a little lower with the 4.5% draw because you're spending less. But the big variable is how much you move out. So if you keep the ERA fully stocked up, right? If you never appropriated another dollar of inflation grouping into principal, you won't hit the ERA. The ERA is like irrelevant. It's going to just get too big, right? But of course, that's the problem with that model is that. Yeah, it's also technically available to spend the entire thing. And I know that's been a fear of certain people in Alaska, is if you leave it in there, at some point you'll get a legislature that just decides to spend it all. So, it's an interesting dynamic because if you want to sustain the draw, you want to keep as much money in the ERA as possible as long as you have a two-account system. And again, I mentioned this in the last meeting, but to me, preserving principal is about having a sustainable draw. And so if you can take the idea off the table of just spending the entire ERA, just take that out of the legislature's hands, and you just replace that with a sustainable draw, and you probably have to do that constitutionally, that protects the principal. That's your best shot at protecting principal. Your second best shot is to take all the money out of the ERA every chance you get, but that has the collateral damage effect that when the markets go down, you may not be able to make a draw at all. So I'll stop there, but I think that answers your question.
Senator Keel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Do members of the Finance Committee have further questions of Mr. Allen? Mr. Allen, thank you for that presentation. It makes a lot of sense to me, at least. So we will move on to the second item on today's agenda. The second item is Senate Bill 227, State Compact Sales Tax, Oil and Gas Tax. I invite Senator Geisel and Senator Wilikowski to the table to reintroduce Senate Bill 227 to the committee.
Uh, Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel. I represent Senate District E in Anchorage.
Good morning. Bill Walkowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to begin the review of Senate Bill 227. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 227 is a revenue proposal. It requires some economic decisions, just as you today and this committee are making some economic decisions about the percent of market value. Mr. Chairman, you and your fellow co-chairs and I have spent a lifetime in this state. We are what Senator Coghill used to call territorial kids. We've been here a very long time. And we have lived through some interesting history, economic history, for our state, Mr. Chairman. We were here when oil was discovered on the Kenai Peninsula, which opened the door for our state to become a state. We paid an income tax during this time. We paid an education tax at this time. In 1968, we were here when oil was discovered on the North Slope. Mr. Chairman, that required the construction of the Trans-Alaska pipeline system, the largest mega project in the world at that time, certainly in the Arctic, Mr. Chairman. But first, in 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act had to be enacted. This was a huge economic decision that has made a massive difference in our state, economically, for our whole state, not just for the Native corporations and the Native people. Mr. Chairman, in 1974, when TAPS was built, we had a huge influx of people. We had an income tax at that time, Mr. Chairman, that non-residents paid who came here with massive wages to build TAPS. In addition, those folks, non-residents, paid an education tax. This built our economy during this time, Mr. Chairman. So in our history, during all this time that you and I and your other two co-chairs have been here, we've had an income tax, education head tax, that non-residents also paid. Mr. Chairman, in 1980, of course, there was a decision made by a governor to repeal the personal income tax and the education tax. This was very short-sighted, certainly a short-sighted economic decision, Mr. Chairman. Before you in Senate Bill 227 is a menu of ideas for this committee to consider that would return us to responsibly paying for the services that the state needs. It would restore an education tax. It would correct a corporate income tax gap that's been recommended since 2021, Mr. Chairman. And it would implement the governor's idea for a 15 cent per barrel infrastructure tax on throughput through TAPS intended for maintenance of the Dalton Highway. So first, the corporate income tax. Again, Mr. Chairman, you know in 1980 our income tax was repealed. Because of that, IRS entities known as S corporations or limited liability corporations stopped paying taxes because those taxes were levied through the owner's personal income tax. The latest indirect expenditure report, Mr. Chairman, from the Legislative Finance Division of 2024 identifies 11,700 of these S Corporation LLCs entities existing in Alaska. So that's a two-year-old report. Could be more now. Senate Bill 227 is a narrow tax that would levy an income tax on the largest entities, income entities in our state. That's oil and gas entities involved in production and transportation of oil. There are multiple recommendations that have been made over the years for this correction in our corporate tax, Mr. Chairman. In 2021, we had a legislative fiscal policy working group. There are members sitting here today who were on that group. This correction was recommended by them. In January 2021, the indirect expenditure report from the Legislative Finance Division stated, without a state personal income tax, these corporations receive the legal benefits of incorporation without any state tax liability. And then, part of the 2021 comprehensive fiscal policy plan for Alaska, which came from this governor, Mr. Chairman, was presented by the Department of Revenue Commissioner on August 10th, 2021, recommending this correction, Mr. Chairman. This correction would put the S corporations on the same level as the identical companies that are organized as C corporations and who are currently and have been paying this tax. I will make another clarification, Mr. Chairman. Alaska does not have the highest corporate income tax in the U.S. Sometimes that statement is made, Mr. Chairman, and it is inaccurate. Actually, New Jersey's corporate income tax is 11.5%, Minnesota's is 9.8%, Illinois 9.5%. Alaska's highest corporate income tax is 9.4%. Just a data point, Mr. Chairman. The potential revenue from this correction is estimated by the Department of Revenue right now as about $120 million a year, Mr. Chairman. So remember also that Alaska's S corporations who would pay this tax can deduct the state tax they pay from their federal income tax, Mr. Chairman. The education payroll tax, Mr. Chairman, would be levied on residents and non-residents. I remind us all that about 25% of our workforce today are non-residents. There's provision for refund for overpayment. The fiscal note estimates that we have 465,000 people that would probably be taxpayers under this education tax. It proposes brackets, Mr. Chairman, in the bill, which the Department of Revenue estimates would bring in $14 to $17 million a year. We have run some numbers. If the idea of a $100 flat education tax were implemented, it would bring in approximately $38.5 million a year. Just a data point again, our previous education tax was $10 for the first paycheck every year for every person with a paycheck. This is inflation adjusted to $100, Mr. Chairman. That's a proposal I've heard. I'm just making known what that would bring in. The 15-cent per barrel infrastructure tax on throughput through TAPS is intended in this bill for the maintenance of the Dalton Highway. This was proposed by the governor, Mr. Chairman. It remains in the bill. It's estimated, again, DOR estimates, Department of Revenue estimates, $18 to $32 million a year from that. The intent in this bill is to keep the Dalton Road, the highway, the Hall Road, as we sometimes refer to it, we old-timers, we want to keep it open and safe for the heavy industrial traffic that uses it, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, these are three ideas in this bill. Revenue measures take courage and a long-term vision for the future, Mr. Chairman, and that's exactly what this committee is doing with the other bill you just heard Callan present about. So I respectfully submit these three proposals for your consideration. I'll turn it over now to Senator Wilikowski.
Do we have questions of Senator Giesel at this point? I do believe that there's a lot of discussion on at least the one, the school tax, and I think it was a sort of a consensus that it be a flat tax at this table. So we will at least be pursuing that. The S-Corp, I believe, although it's in this bill, we have passed that bill on to the Rules Committee. With that, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator, East Anchorage. I would just add on the Dalton Highway that we had testimony in the Senate Resources Committee from the DOT Commissioner, who testified that they expect to need to spend about $450 million on repairs for the Dalton Highway over the next 6 years. That's about $75 million per year that the state of Alaska is subsidizing that road, which is predominantly used by the industry. This bill would raise anywhere from, as Senator Giesel mentioned, $18 to $32 million. So it's capturing a portion of the cost that we need to fund that road. The bill also removes a major component, which was the sales tax. There was a lot of opposition to that from communities, from the public of Alaska. That provision has been removed. Oil taxes, there was a change, an amendment that was run to change our current net profits tax structure, which is a 35% net tax to a gross 17.5% tax. The governor in his bill recognized that our current tax structure is not capturing the value that we should be getting for our oil. His proposal was to increase the floor on our tax structure from 4% to 6%. Under the...
What date was that?
When
he made that recommendation?
It's in the current bill. It was in the bill that was proposed by Governor Dunleavy.
And when was that proposed?
This year, weeks ago. Sorry, maybe 2 months ago.
Thank you.
And that was to increase the floor from 4% to 6%. The problem, and we would certainly suggest at the very minimum that everybody recognizes that our oil tax structure is not working as it was proposed. If you look at the fall forecast, and I only do this from the fall forecast because we don't have an income statement under the spring forecast, but in 2026, even though we have a 4% floor and a 35% net profits tax, the gross production tax value that we got was 3.3%. In 2027, according to the fall forecast, and I know the numbers have changed, but I don't have an income statement for under the spring forecast. The projection was that we would get 3.46% of the gross value of our oil as a production tax. We have a 4% floor. We're not getting that, Mr. Chairman. And if you raise it to 6%, we're still not going to get 6% because we have all kinds of other provisions in there that allow the industry to pierce that floor and go below 4%. So we would suggest at a minimum that our structure needs to be fixed. And there's a variety of problems with it. We all heard, and people were very happy, that we had a very successful NPRA bids. I think it was $173 million. Industry acquired leases in NPRA. The problem with that is, in the short term and medium term, the lease developments on those properties will, if they're done by incumbent producers who are currently producing in Alaska, those would decimate our budget. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because every dollar that they spend there, they will be able to write off of their production taxes here in Alaska. And we're seeing this with the Willow Project, where we know that this year alone, it's costing us at least $300 million. Now with oil prices increasing, it could be as high as $500 million. It could even be higher than that. Off of our production taxes, they get to write off. So if they spend $1 billion, they get to write off $350 million of that. We think they spent $1.5 billion, which means they could potentially be writing off over $500 million off of our production taxes. That's a direct loss to the Treasury of the state of Alaska. So, at least Willow goes into production, another flaw is exposed, in that at least for the Willow Project, we get no royalties. And then there's another provision that kicks in, the gross value reduction, GVR, which will reduce their taxes by 30%, allowing them to pierce the minimum floor also on that. And so all kinds of problems in our current tax structure. We picked the 17.5% because when combined with our royalty rate, that gets us to less than 30% when you factor in transportation costs and other write-off costs. And we're trying to simply capture roughly a third of the value of our oil, And in Texas, North Dakota, they're capturing anywhere from 28 to 35% of the value of their oil between royalties and taxes, and we believe that we should be on par with them. We've often been told that we need to be competitive and compared to them. So I'll stop right there, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the committee's time, and happy to answer any questions.
The additional problem that has been presented to this committee and has had a lot of discussion is transparency. Can you address that? And, if not, why not? Was that included, and do you see a fix to that problem?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Lukowski again for the record. Yes, transparency is a huge problem. You've probably heard me ask questions of our revenue commissioner over the years. How much profit did a certain company make when they come in and testify that Alaska, if we do change the tax structure, will become unprofitable or not as competitive? They won't tell us. They will not tell us because of our confidentiality laws. In fact, I have a direct quote from Rich Ruggiero, who was a consultant for many years for the legislature through Gaffney and Klein and then ultimately Castle Rock. And he said back on March 1st, 2017, in front of the Senate Resources Committee, quote, "The state is actually making decisions with a whole lot less information than similar bodies in the other governments he works for." And he went on, "If he could make a suggestion, he would say that elsewhere in the world, much more information changes hands than in Alaska, and that data is available to the governments for setting policy." If we're to set policy on our resource, and we're doing so without knowing what profits are, without knowing what internal rates of return are, without knowing what net present values are, and then you have industry coming in saying, if you do this, you're going to harm our profitability, you're going to harm our internal rate of return. We can't make good policy decisions with a lack of information. And our consultants have told us this over the years. We've got the most complex oil tax structure in the world, and we don't have anywhere near the transparency that we need to be able to develop a fair profit structure that ensures that we get the maximum value for our resource.
Are there questions of either Senator Giesel or Senator Wilkowski, Senator Stedman?
Just on the issue of transparency, Mr. Chairman, I think looking at it from a different viewpoint, I understand the issue, I think, that Senator Wilkowski brought up, you know, wanting to look at individual companies' data. I think looking at it from another direction, my concern is with the lack of transparency is when we set forth a policy that has financial implications for both the industry and the state, we don't have the ability to go in and see if the policy is actually working to the advantage or disadvantage of the state or the advantage of the disadvantage to the industry. A classic example was Point Thompson, when we encouraged the development of Point Thompson with Exxon and pushed that forward under previous administrations. This goes back to Murkowski days. And then the development went forward in Point Thompson. It was very expensive. We had huge credits at the time. We had billions in credits expensed into Point Thompson. And, you know, Point Thompson was, you know, the development started in Point Thompson. They had to run a feeder line over and so on and so forth. But then at the end of the day, when that development was done and under production, a simple question is for us is, did policy work or not? Was it a financial gain or loss? And the status and the revenue and Department of Natural Resources couldn't tell us because of our own confidentiality, which is crazy. So we can't make a judgment if it was good or bad financially, and we can assure there was more money going out than coming in from the state's perspective. And we'd got more information from asking the companies directly what was going on than we could get from our own departments. And that's crazy, in my opinion. So I'm thankful that the industry at least took the initiative to tell us pretty much, you know, on the high level, what was going on as far as credit expenditures and costs. But when we can't get it out of our own department, there's something wrong with the structure. That's just one example. Another example is when we looked at Cook Inlet years ago, we were putting hundreds of millions of dollars every year in Cook Inlet, and we had trouble figuring out if we're going forward or backwards on Cook Inlet. When we had non-cashable credits, we had billions going out, and I think we ended up with a $800 million bill at the end. It took a few years to work through and pay that off. We couldn't go in and measure the success or magnitude of difficulty with that other than, you know, from a guessing level. And we all knew that in that case, I think there was estimates that there might have been a billion going out the door and nothing coming in. And that, you know, that doesn't work. So anyway, there's transparency is an issue. I think we need to look at that. I'm personally not interested in so much, you know, company by company. I'm interested in policy by policy.
I would concur with that. people, Senator Olson.
What suggestion you have for this, the policy?
What should we have in it?
Yes.
Well, that's a good question. I think we're going to have some help with that with some our consultants or in the department and some discussion with the industry and come up with something that kind of works for both sides because the industry is our partner. And if they don't succeed, we're not going to succeed and vice versa. So, and the dynamics of the industry has changed since the last time we've dealt into it in any depth. It's probably been 15 years or however long. It's been a long time, decade. So, and the industry's changing as we speak the last month. So we need some help.
People should realize that it is our oil. The state of Alaska owns that oil. And we have a constitutional requirement to get our fair share. Maybe Senator Wilkowski, could you speak to that provision of our Constitution?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, our Constitution does say that we have an obligation to get the maximum value for our resource. And when you look at how much we're getting, I don't think we're meeting that constitutional requirement.
Brief Eddies. People may be asking why we're dealing with this issue at this time, and I think it's clear when you look at last year when we passed the operating budget, we felt that it was balanced, but after consideration, this governor came forward, and I would say that Governor Dunleavy is probably one of the more conservative governors that I've had the pleasure of working with. But as a result of that, we have seen supplementals in excess of $500 million. What does this tell me? When you have a conservative governor coming forward with over half a billion dollar request, that tells me that we've nowhere else to cut. We've hit the bottom. We would have to start eliminating programs. And we have been fortunate, the state of Alaska has been fortunate because of the war. It hasn't been fortunate for the rest of the world, but it has bailed us out temporarily. We are seeing possibly an increase of $500 million on a temporary basis. So if we want to continue to provide the necessary services after the price settles down, education has taken front stage today. We have the other body and this body addressing the inadequacies of a BSA that we passed last year. We increased the BSA. But even with that increase, the municipality of Anchorage or the Anchorage School District still is facing a $90 million reduction. There has been a $150 million increase proposed by the other body, but even with that $150 million, this would only fund $44 million of the $90 million reduction or deficit that the municipality of Anchorage is facing. And I'm using Anchorage as a basis, but throughout our state, education is in a crisis. And if we don't come up with a long-term funding solution, we know that the investment of our children is the basis of any society having an educated population. So it is with that that I believe the state of Alaska is at a crossroads, and what we do with it, I think, is the responsibility of the Finance Committee to come up and propose some long-term solutions, at least to balance the services that the citizens of Alaska have been come to expect. So any closing comments by Senator Giesel or Senator Wilkowski before we listen to invited testimony from Robert Brennan? Senator Stedman.
I've got a couple ones. The Dalton Highway, it's kind of the lifeline to our oil patch, and without that, we're in trouble. Clearly, there's looks like there's $75 million, Mr. Chairman, required a year to do the Dalton. One mechanism, I guess, would be to do this tax that the governor proposed. But has there been any consideration in the pros and cons of reclassifying that to an industrial road and have the industry take it over so they can keep that road into the condition that best services them or not? I'm just kind of curious. And the reason I bring that up, we had a colleague that was with us from Fairbanks for a few years and now off wanting to be the next governor or something. And he talked about an industrial road dealing with a mine out of Fairbanks because of the lack of maintenance on the highway by the DOT. So is this something that maybe we should ask DOT and revenue? Should it be considered or not? I have no idea.
I think that is an excellent question for the department. I don't know if the resources chairman would be the individual to answer that question, but do you think that that's a valid question that should be asked of the department?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, certainly this, Kathy Giesel for the record, certainly a legitimate question to ask the Department of Transportation, Mr. Chairman. I have no information.
We will ask that question. Senator Stedman, further?
Well, I just think, Mr. Chairman, you know, that would be a deductible expenditure and required, so it's not a, you know, I don't think it would be an issue there, but that was the main 2 points I thought I'd bring up.
Senator Keel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, on the industrial highway approach, I would flag, in case anyone's not familiar, there's a couple different ways to do those. In some cases, an industrial use highway is closed to the public and the industry pays for it. But in other cases, and I think about the Klondike Highway, runs from Skagway up to the Canadian border, it is an industrial use highway. There are charges for the industry, the very heavy vehicles that use that. It's also open to the general public. And you can pull off at the Captain William Henry Moore Bridge and take lovely pictures and sightsee. But at the same time, the bulk of that cost is paid by the industrial users who make heavy use of that. And so there are hybrid models that have the potential to serve well for something like the Dalton that gets some use by Alaskans, along with the heavy use by Alaska's biggest industry.
Further questions, Senator Stedman?
Well, I don't know where the conversation is going today, but this bill is proposed in front of us has a gross tax. Is it? Mr. Chairman, are we going to talk about that, just the committee, or some comments on it?
Yes, we are. We're going to ask Senator Wilkowski to comment on that and versus a net tax, I think, that you're interested in. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We do have time because we're still having difficulties on a phone line for our testifier. So
okay.
We have time to address that.
Yeah, thank you. For decades, Alaska had a gross tax, and the gross tax was at 12.5%. It declared that certain marginal, as fields became marginal, under the economic limit factor, that the tax rate would decline. The 12.5% gross tax plus our 12.5% royalty got us 25% when you added in the couple other taxes, corporate income taxes, property taxes. We had, for decades, we were getting about 27% of the value for our, 27% of the value for our oil. That was our share, rather. During ACEs, that number jumped up to around 37%. And so we've all heard Governor Hammond suggest that the fair share for the state and the feds and the industry should be a third, a third, a third. We've historically gotten 27 to 37%. So sort of in that range. Now we're getting around 16, 17%. So much lower, roughly half of what we had previously gotten. The challenge, and industry persuaded us to go from a gross tax to a net tax under PPT, and then under ACEs, that was hotly debated, and there were concerns that we wouldn't be able to keep up with the auditing, we wouldn't be able to keep up with the tax attorneys and the accountants, and I would suggest that they were correct, that people were correct in that assumption, because we haven't. And in fact, right now, with the dispute that we're going with the Department of Revenue and them refusing to provide us with audit information for a number of years, first time in state history, we haven't gotten that information. That's been a real challenge. And if the other problem that we had under the ELF when we tried to structure it in a way to take into account declining fields, the way it was written, we actually ended up having Kuparuk, the second largest field in North America at the time, paying a zero tax rate. And the idea was that as the tax rate declined, then production would increase. And if you look at the production rate versus the decline in taxes, what you see is that as the tax rate went down, production went down just right along with it. And so it did not have the it did not increase production as we were told that it would. Instead, the state just got less money, and industry made more money. And so the net profits tax, it's good in concept if you can keep up on the auditing. But the problem is we have so many holes in it between the gross value reduction and the allowability to deduct lease expenditures on fields for which we get no royalties and fields for which we get very little in taxes. And then if you remember in Senate Bill 21, we had oil tax credits. That was hotly debated. And we had when the bill left the Senate, it had a $5 cap on oil tax credits. And then in the House at the last minute, that was increased to $8. And so if you have 154 million barrels of oil going down the pipeline every year, every dollar that in increased oil tax credits is potentially $154 million in lost revenue to the state of Alaska. And so that's perhaps one of the reasons why Governor Dunleavy's Department of Revenue Commissioner several years ago suggested that we cut that from $8 to $5 back to where it was when it left the Senate. That's potentially $450 million in additional revenue to the state of Alaska. And in fact, when I served on this committee years ago, I asked the deputy commissioner at the time if they had done an analysis of cutting the oil tax credits from $8 to $5 and whether it would impact investment decisions. And they said no. They said no, it wouldn't impact investment decisions. In fact, we asked Gaffney and Klein the same questions, and they said no, it wouldn't impact investment decisions. So I think we're simply shifting too much money from the people of Alaska to the industry right now. And I think, unfortunately, we have not been able to keep pace with the industry in terms of lease expenditures and deductions and tax breaks to the point now where we're getting such a low share for the value of our oil. And that just a gross tax is simple. Oil comes out at $100 a barrel, we have a gross tax in place, whether it's 17.5% or 12.5% where it historically was for many years under our statehood. That's the number they pay. They get a little bit of deductions for it. And we don't have to worry about auditing. We don't have to worry about lease expenditures. We don't have to worry about gross value reductions. We don't have to worry about all the challenges and problems that we've had. It's a simple number. It's what they do in Texas. It's what they do in North Dakota. It's what they do in every other state in the country. There's no other state in the United States that has the complex net profits tax structure that we have. None. Nobody. One of the benefits of having a net profits tax is when oil prices get high, you capture the value. It's essentially a windfall profits tax. And that's what we had under ACES. And we had record high investment, record high jobs. And the industry was making record profits at the time. And they successfully persuaded the legislature to cut our share, saying that we'd get more jobs, that we'd get save the PFD. That was on their flyer, save the PFD. And so here we are now. The PFD has not been saved. In fact, our share, oil used to fund 90% of our revenue for our state for decades, and now it funds 23%. And so the jobs went from 15,300 in August of 2014, the very month that we had the ballot initiative on oil taxes by the people of Alaska, the referendum, down to 9,000 now. So there's been massive cuts in jobs. The PFD has not been saved. The promises that were made to get these tax cuts have not been lived up to. And so we need to revisit it. It's our obligation. And we're clearly, we're getting 3.5% gross oil tax on our production. That's clearly not getting enough. That's clearly not. Even the governor recognizes it. And that's why he's suggesting we put it at a 6% floor. I don't think that's enough. I think it should be higher than that. But that's up to this committee to have a debate and decide on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Stedman.
Yeah, just a couple of things. I think it's all good food for thought. We want to remember that we're the only state in the union that owns a subsurface, so we're structured different. So when we compare ourselves to North Dakota, the farmers own the subsurface, generally speaking, Texas cattle ranchers or whoever. Here it's the people of Alaska, so we're a little different animal, so we're going to look different. But let's I want to just make a point that dealing with the gross tax has some, it's a little bit problematic in several areas. The tax, as I understand it, is on the gross value point of production, which sounds like gobbledygook, but it's basically revenue less a net back for shipping our oil, and it's before royalties. And then, so the tax would then be hit before royalties, and royalties come out, and our royalty or old structures, all of that, that are under contract, most of them, that are not going to change. So you have the gross tax on that number, and then you have some problems with the marginal fields. But what I'd like to suggest, Mr. Chairman, as we have the net run, and I think Senator Wilkowski is using 17.5%. So, you know, I just want to keep things simple, because just for discussion points, let's use 17, and let's run it on the production tax value, which is after expenditures, after royalties, after shipping costs, basically the net profit. Run it at 17%. But then let's run another exercise at 21%. That's the corporate tax rate. And the reason I'm asking that for that is when we set the rate at the current rate at 35%, that was the corporate tax rate at the time. That corporate tax rate has been changed to 21, and we didn't follow up and change our structure. And then delete out the per barrel slider, and delete out gross or the GVR, the gross value reduction, because that's taking a gross calculation against a net. So the magnitude is significant when you look at 30% or 20% of the gross and slam it against the net on new oil. And take a look at that run, Mr. Chairman. But what that's going to also show, we still, I would expect we're going to have to deal with marginal fields. And marginal fields are our future to get to increased production. And I would also like to point out that one area that the current tax code was very successful at, and that was, maybe we can argue if it was good or bad for the revenue of the state in any given time, but it definitely helped accelerate the expansion within the oil basin itself with the fields. And there's enough potential up there on hydrocarbons that last for decades if we don't, you know, tip the balance too far one way or the other. So, Mr. Chairman, that's what I'd like to have Department of Revenue do, and then actually see what it looks like. I'm just curious.
We'll go ahead and have that done by the Department of Revenue and see what when that can be provided. If not, we may ask our consultants as well to do it, and we'll get back with a time frame. Are there further comments?
You had one just in for the Cape Horns, you're picking up the gross tax in you'd suggest that?
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Stedman's suggestion is a good one. I think looking at the gross tax and looking at different rates are a good idea. I think we can all agree that what we're doing right now is not working. I think one of the big concerns that we have is how we're going to go forward on new fields. And I think Senator Stedman makes a good point that there is a big difference between the legacy fields and the new fields. And there probably does need to be some distinction between them. The new fields are more expensive, clearly. What we're seeing, though, is if you look at Pica and if you look at Willow, Pica's on state land, Willow's on federal land. Pica is being developed by a company that doesn't have a current production base. And so Santos, they can't write off any of their costs off their current structure. And yet they're still developing it. When it goes into development, they'll be able to carry forward those costs. But on Willow, because it's being developed by an incumbent producer, they are writing off all their costs right now. And so I think as a state, we need to look at how this is impacting our finances going forward. We need a more stable system. And I think when you have a system structured like ours where you constantly allow for write-offs on new fields, we never get to the point where we have increased revenue. In fact, if you look at the revenue projections, you'll see we are expecting more production, but we have a decline in revenue. And that's because the new fields are very expensive, and they're just writing off all their expenses on, and we never catch up. We never make the money, and they'll be. And now with this new lease sale in NPRA, I fear this is going to have a very, very dramatic impact on our future budgeting for the next probably decade, and it will end up costing us huge amounts of money, and we'll never get to the point where we can balance our budget.
Senator Stedman.
And just if I could ask for another issue, Mr. Chairman, I think dealing with the concern of the carry forwards is, I think, what you're referring to, carry forward write offs. One of the things that we don't have in our system that I think we should have, or at least we should seriously consider having, and that's a cost recovery limit, which would be in any given year, say you've got X amount of dollars in your severance tax, is what we're talking about. In any given company, we only give up so much of that, 40%, 60%, 50%, some number that we would give up to take the carry forwards, so they can take the carry forwards against for the deduction, because if they don't deduct and have the ability to deduct their costs, their economics don't work. So they have to be able to deduct their costs. What we're talking about is a timing of how fast they get to deduct them. So by putting in a cost limit, our cost recovery limit, that ensures that the sovereign, which is us, gets a revenue cash flow into the state all the time. Because one of the things that I think is concerning looking forward of doing nothing is when oil production goes to 650,000 barrels, which is significantly higher than it is today, and our revenue goes down, the public's going to go berserk. That doesn't work. And I think it's bad PR for the industry and bad PR for the state. There's no winners in that. So I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that when we ask for that simple run of 17% and 21% on the net, that when they calculate that, they get rid of the $5 slider, they get rid of the GVR, they put in a cost recovery limit, started at 50-50 just to see what it looks like. Maybe they'll recommend it's 90-10, we keep 10, they get 90, or 60-40, who knows what it's going to look like. But we need to consider that. And we didn't do that under the current system. So when we look at $2 to $3 billion in carry forwards, it helps the economics of the field, but it puts us in a kind of a tight predicament revenue-wise.
We'll go ahead and request that. We've been bringing this up the second time. Hopefully, we will come forward with some additional revenue measures other than the three that we've decided. I've been here at this table for over 20 years, and one of the problems that I see is we come up with temporary fixes to budget issues such as we're facing today, and the other body has passed a budget to fill, as I said earlier, $150 million to education. I think by doing that, it alleviates the pressure from us acting on longer-term revenue measures. And I, for one, have not been supportive of spending money on a one-time basis and then having to reduce those in future years because we don't come up with revenue measures. So for the members here, unless convinced otherwise, I think that needs to be addressed. We need to keep the pressure on, and we need to come up with a long-term solution. And that may mean some short-term pain, but we need a longer-term solution. Do you have any closing comments? We're going to take a brief at ease while we get our next testifier, presenter to get online. Senator Kaufman, do you have a comment?
I'll wait.
Okay. With that, we'll take a brief at ease for a few minutes while we get the next testifier online. All Senate Finance Committee, back to order. We've finally fixed the technical difficulties we've had with our connection. Robin Brenna, can you hear us now? Hello? Is he online? Are you muted? Hello? This is only 2026, so we have smile problems. He's not there?
I think that's the house.
Still not working. We will temporarily, we will adjourn this meeting and try to reconnect and fix a problem and be back at 1:30. Since the bells are going to be ringing in another 20 minutes as well, so we'll adjourn till this afternoon.